Welcome to How to Save Your Life. How to Save Your Life is produced with the assistance of the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. Your host is Dr. Philip Stieg, Chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery and Neurosurgeon-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital.
Welcome to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, your host. Have you ever noticed that your body is shaking more? Do you notice that your legs are stiff and woody and you can't get around? Or do you have intractable pain that is unbearable and you've tried medications and seen multiple doctors? For answers to such perplexing problems as these, stay with us as we meet with Dr. Michael Caplet. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. Have you noticed that you're shaking more lately? Are your legs stiff? Do you have a new facial twitch? The answer regarding how to treat these symptoms will be explored in detail this evening. I'm Dr. Philip E. Stieg, your host, and I have with me this evening Dr. Michael Caplet. Dr. Caplet is an associate professor of neurological surgery at Weill Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. He is the Victor and Tara Menezes Clinical Scholar in Neurosciences at that institution. And he is the gentleman who has led the first ever gene therapy program for Parkinson's disease. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Caplet here with us. He's got an international reputation for the treatment of stereotactic and functional disorders. Now, Mike, you know, I imagine that that makes great cocktail conversation when somebody says that, you know, he's a stereotactic functional neurosurgeon.
Yeah, it keeps my parents happy.
Yeah. can you please, you know, put that in terms that, you know, that we can understand. I mean, what do you really do?
Yeah. Well, the name sort of describes two aspects of the specialty. The stereotactic part is a fancy way of saying how we do the operations that we do. What I do is try to get to parts of the brain that are difficult to access through more open surgery that's done for tumors and other things, using advanced computer-type techniques so that we can change the way the brain functions, which gets to the second part, which is the functional neurosurgery. What the diseases that I take care of are diseases that are not immediately life-threatening usually, but are those diseases that make us who we are as human beings. So it affects the function of the brain, and that includes things like movement disorders, Parkinson's disease, tremors. It encompasses, to some degree, epilepsy and seizures, and complex pain for people who have pain from a variety of disorders.
So Parkinson's disease, to my understanding, is becoming more common. Is that just a perception of mine? Are we diagnosing it better? You know, how common is it in the society?
Well, I think it is a combination of both. It's not entirely clear, but it's being discussed quite extensively in the community. There's no question that the awareness of Parkinson's disease has been raised significantly in recent years because of certain celebrities that have had the disorder, as well as just a greater overall awareness among the general population of what Parkinson's disease means. Previously, if somebody reached their 70s or 80s and they were slowing down or they had a little bit of a tremor, people would simply say, well, you know, that's the way it is. But a lot of people are recognizing it for what it is now. Having said that, there does seem to be possibly a slight increase, and nobody's exactly sure why, because to date we really don't know what actually causes Parkinson's disease.
So who's at risk? Are we all walking around at risk, or is it more common males or females?
Yeah, well, the only real known risk factor for Parkinson's disease is age. While it happens in younger people, it's exceedingly rare, and it tends to increase with frequency, particularly as you get into the 50s and 60s. So there are some famous situations where people have had it at a younger age, in their 30s or even 20s sometimes. Occasionally, that might be due to causes other than natural causes. Somebody has a stroke, somebody has abused drugs or had a trauma. But for what we call routine or sporadic Parkinson's, which is the majority of patients who just get it for no known reason, the only real risk factor is age. There has been some association with pesticides, which is the only thing that's ever really been shown. It's a weak association, but it is real, I think. If you give certain pesticides or components of pesticides to animals, you can get them to become Parkinsonian. And there have been some studies of epidemiology where you look at large populations of people that have shown that people who do an excessive amount of gardening or who are farmers can have a slight increase in the disease.
Were there certain drugs years ago that were used that may have induced, and they're not marketed anymore?
Well, there were drugs that were never marketed. There was a very famous spate of Parkinsonism among young people who were abusing a street drug in California in the early 80s. And in fact, the gold standard way in which we create models of Parkinson's in monkeys to test new therapies is to actually use the active component, the active compound from that toxin, which is called MPTP, that is given to the monkeys and they get Parkinsonian. And it was all because it was recognized by some practitioners in California when these people in their 20s were coming in, they looked like a 70-year-old Parkinson's patient. And like many great discoveries, the people were perceptive enough to recognize that there might be something there, and they found this active compound.
Amazing. Is there any environmental or genetic component to this disease, or is it purely sporadic?
Well, no, actually. And so there's about 5% of patients, it's estimated right now, that have an inherited form of Parkinson's. And that's become incredibly valuable to us as scientists in trying to figure out those things that might influence the onset and the causes of Parkinson's disease. When people have an inherited form, they usually have a mutation or a change in one particular gene. And there have now been about 7 genes that have been identified that absolutely cause Parkinson's in those selective families, meaning that you can almost predict the frequency of Parkinson's from one generation to the next, like any inherited disease. But that is very unusual. The reason it's important, you'd say, well, okay, but that only affects a small number of patients. But let's talk about something that everybody knows about, heart disease. Part of the way in which we now know about the importance of LDLs and HDLs, which is in the vocabulary of everyone now, it wasn't 20 years ago.
Those are the lipids.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those people who were looking at it originally, for example, Brown and Goldstein, who won the Nobel Prize for this, they did most of their original work looking at the rare inherited forms of hypercholesterolemia, where people have obscene cholesterol levels. Now we say that people should have a cholesterol level under 200, which is lower than it used to be, and some think it should be even lower than that. These are people who have cholesterol levels in the 400s, let's say, and it's inherited. And they found that there were these rare changes or mutations in genes that help you handle these lipids, these, you know, LDLs and HDLs. And by finding those, they then found that similar things were going wrong, but to a milder degree, in the general population. Not because they had a grossly abnormal gene, but normal is always a relative term. And so there's always a range of normal function. And so you or I might have a gene that is normal, but yours may work a little better than mine. And if you have 10 or 20 of those, that could add up to being more or less sensitive. And that's the way we now evaluate someone's risk factor when we say, do you have a family history of heart disease? Yeah. So my hope is that with Parkinson's disease, by understanding what's going wrong in these very clear-cut genetic cases, that we will eventually be able to understand how those relate to the more garden variety general population and eventually be able to give people a similar idea of their risk factor as what we do for heart disease today.
Yeah, I mean, asking about environmental things is probably a little bit of a loaded question. You know, I was thinking along the lines of, you know, Muhammad Ali with the the boxing. You know, how does that work?
Well, there is a phrase actually called Parkinson's pugilistica that has been coined because Parkinson's disease has been recognized in people who are boxers who have repetitive head injuries. Like a lot of disorders, there's no question that repetitive head injuries can take their toll and can cause a Parkinson's-like disease. It's not usually quite identical to routine Parkinson's, but it is very similar. Having said that, it's clearly not the only cause. I have no idea what someone like Muhammad Ali would have done had they not been a boxer. But my suspicion is that, like I said earlier, he may not have an abnormal gene in a particular gene, but he may have a constellation of genetics. He may have a genetic background that might have made him a little more sensitive, because anybody who knows boxing, for example, would know that Muhammad Ali's thing was that he was actually never hit nearly as much in the head or the face as some of his contemporaries, like Joe Frazier, for example, who doesn't have Parkinson's disease and got hit substantially more. There have been studies of families of boxers, actually, where some have gotten Parkinson's and others have not. So there's clearly an interplay between environment and genetics that we don't fully understand that increases your risk factor. But even with the gardening, for example, I don't want to suggest that people should stop watering their plants or going out and having a flower in their backyard. It's all a matter of risk and of dose. Even though your risk may be elevated, none of these things rise to the level of a major risk. The vast majority of people who are gardeners do not have Parkinson's disease, but it simply does can potentially elevate your risk if you're susceptible.
My father-in-law had Parkinson's disease, and I didn't see him that often, and I'm ashamed to know the state that I didn't pick it up early in his diagnosis. You know, what's the patient and what's the family going to see when they start coming down with these, with the symptoms related to Parkinson's disease?
Yeah. You know, very often when I see patients and I ask them about when they were diagnosed, most of the time people will say, well, I was diagnosed in X year, but I know I had symptoms for 2 years before that, because most people, especially if it's a disease of aging, it's natural for us to think, well, if I'm slowing down or I'm developing a little bit of a problem, it could be due to a lot of things. Maybe I have a herniated disc in my neck. I have some neck problem. Maybe I'm just tired. Maybe I'm not getting enough blood to my brain anymore because of, you know, hardening of the arteries. So these things are natural, but Parkinson's really constitutes a very specific type of symptom. A resting tremor, not a tremor. If you're sitting there at rest and you go to pick up a cup of coffee or a drink and you have a little bit of a tremor as you move, that's not a Parkinsonian type tremor. Parkinson's tremor is you're sitting there at rest and your hand or your leg is shaking a little bit, usually fairly rhythmically and regular, 3-4 beats per second type thing. A lot of Parkinson's patients don't have tremors, though, or it's not a big part of their disease. Even though people think of Parkinson's as a tremor disease, you can also have freezing where you just can't move as well. You try to start a movement and you notice that you're just having trouble getting it going, not because of pain, not because of anything else. You just seem like you're a little slow at getting going. And then the third thing is muscle stiffness. You can feel stiff like you do after you've worked out or something, but it's without pain and it's all the time.
Are there any psychological components related to this?
Well, there can be. It's usually later in the disease. So depression is a very major part of Parkinson's. And I always try to discriminate between depression and sadness, because people use the word depression a lot in their lives. It's reasonable to be sad because you have a disease like Parkinson's disease. Depression is where, even if things are going well, you're having major problems with motivating yourself, with getting up. That is a real organic problem that happens in Parkinson's and that is underappreciated, and that can be treated with antidepressants if it's well recognized. Problems with memory and things like that can happen, but it's usually later in the disease and it's in a lesser number of patients. So if that happens very early on, in all likelihood, it may be something other than true Parkinson's disease.
With all these varied symptoms, are you describing a situation where one doctor handles this, multiple doctors?
Yeah. Well, often early in the disease, Parkinson's is fairly well recognized by neurologists or even internists, and it can be fairly well managed by any neurologist with modern medication. The tough thing comes as the disease progresses. Even with medication, patients can get worse over time and develop a variety of symptoms that usually require a much more multidisciplinary type approach with specialists in movement disorder neurology, physical therapists, and then eventually surgeons if it really gets to a point where surgery can be helpful.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we return, we'll talk about what types of surgery are available, when should they be done, are they safe, how effective are they, or should you just stick with medication? Please stay with us. Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, and with me this evening is Dr. Michael Caplet, the Victor and Tara Meneses Clinical Scholar in Neurosciences at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. Before we left, we were talking about the management of Parkinson's disease and the signs and the symptoms, and we're just getting into how to treat this with medicines. You know, can you give the listeners an overview of what common medications they're going to be taking if they have Parkinson's disease?
Well, all of the medications right now relate to what is believed to be the fundamental problem that happens in Parkinson's. There are cells in the brain that die, and we don't know why they die, and that's the discussion we had earlier. But we know a lot about what happens once those cells die. And those cells make a chemical called dopamine that regulates a circuit in the brain that helps control and regulate movements. When that dopamine is missing, the circuit tends to go a little bit hyperactive, and that happens more and more over time, and that then widely affects the rest of the brain's ability to function normally. So most of the medications are designed to try to replace this dopamine. One of the obvious limitations of any medication is that where the dopamine problem occurs is only in one spot of the brain, but the medication bathes the brain, of course, and so you can already imagine that there could be potential problems, and that does limit the therapy to some degree. Nonetheless, early in the disease, these medicines are extraordinarily effective. So one medicine is called levodopa, which was actually discovered in the 1960s. For those of your listeners who saw the movie Awakenings with Robin Williams, that was based on a real individual who had gone to a hospital in the 1960s and saw all these patients who were essentially locked in and couldn't move. Well, many of those patients had Parkinson's disease, and there was not much that could be done in those days to treat them. So they became more and more frozen to the point where they simply could not move. Many of them had gotten Parkinson's following an infection. The big flu epidemic in the early 1920s left people with a brain infection and inflammation that caused Parkinson's in many people. So the chemical that he gave them, the powder that he kept measuring out for those who saw the movie, was levodopa, which had just been discovered and for which the Nobel Prize was won in 2000 for that discovery. That was really a miraculous drug in all of neurology. If you think about it, even today, there are few drugs in the neurosciences that take a person who cannot move at all, and within 45 minutes, they can move almost like normal. It was really conceived of as a miracle. So for about 20 years, people thought that this would be the cure for Parkinson's disease. However, over time, more and more of these dopamine cells die off, so you need more of these drugs. And in addition, people can develop side effects from the drugs because the brain just does not like seeing high doses of any chemical, any neurochemical, for long periods of time. It was not designed to work that way, even though you need it to treat the disease. So over time, you can develop side effects of these medicines, such as involuntary movements where you can't sit still. The word is called dyskinesias, and it's basically a writhing movement. And there are other medicines that can be used now that are more advanced. So in addition to levodopa, which has a commercial name of Sinemet, which is a formulation that makes it work a little longer and a little more effectively, there are drugs that will help the dopamine stay around longer in the brain. There are drugs that will act like dopamine. They're called dopamine agonists. They're being used for other diseases. There's a commercial, for example, for one of them that's being promoted for restless leg syndrome that a lot of people may have seen in the last few weeks. And restless leg is similar to Parkinson's in some degree. And so these same dopamine agonist drugs, which are acting like dopamine, will be used. They have less side effects to some degree, but they also are less effective in the long run. They're very effective early. So these are the drugs people will take, but over time, people still can develop problems, and that we're talking about over an 8 to 10 year period.
So clearly all of these medications, how many are we talking about, 10, 5?
Roughly. I mean, the major classes of drugs, we're really talking about 4 or 5 major classes, and then as with any drug, every drug company has their variant.
Yeah. The complexity of the dosing and all that really needs to be managed by a specialist in this field, in particular a neurologist, and hopefully a neurologist that has a particular interest in Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, early in the disease, often people can take one pill maybe twice a day and do just fine, and that's not very tough to manage. But as the disease gets into these more moderate to advanced stages, I have had patients who are taking pills 9 or 10 times a day. I have patients sometimes who are waking up in the middle of the night to take their medicine because they know that if they don't, they're going to be much worse in the morning, or they won't be able to sleep because they can't turn over naturally. So yes, it can be very complicated to manage some of these medicines.
What are the, you listed some of the side effects just in terms of the agitation and the jerking movements, or what you call the dyskinesias. Right. Are there other problems that you can run into with these medications?
Sure. Well, in addition to those, and in addition to the fact that, like I said, people can simply become resistant or have what's known as wearing off phenomenons over time, where early in the disease, there's a concept in Parkinson's of being on and being off. On is when everything's working. Off is when you're not doing so well. So early in the disease, people may spend 12 or 14 of their 16 waking hours in the on state, and that can completely turn around by 8 or 10 years into the disease. So in addition to those kinds of problems, more recently people have recognized, for example, some patients can have exacerbation of addictive-type behaviors. People have noticed gambling addictions. I've had patients who have gone to do some minor gambling, let's say I would go to Las Vegas for the weekend, and you lose a few bucks, and now suddenly they're losing $100,000, and they don't understand why they're so compelled to do this.
So I've got Parkinson's disease, and I've gone through the medication milieu, and I'm having more off time.
Yeah.
Should I wait that long? Where I want to go is, when's the best time to think about having surgery?
Right.
Early on to kind of prevent, or should I wait until surgery is the only option?
Well, it's a big debate right now. Surgery right now is usually reserved for patients who have more moderate to advanced disease. Right now, our philosophy is that if someone is doing reasonably well on only a few pills a day and they're pretty consistent from day to day, that surgery probably doesn't make sense. There's no evidence right now that the current way we do surgery can prevent or slow down the disease. It simply treats the symptoms better when the medicines are less effective. What surgery right now will do is make your medicines work more effectively. It will increase the amount of on time throughout the day. Studies show on average about 6 hours, which is a significant portion of the day. It will reduce some of the side effects, like these involuntary movements and things, and it can allow you to reduce the amount of medication you're taking by, on average, about 50%. So for those patients who are on a lot of medicine with a lot of off time, a lot of fluctuations where one day they're doing great and one day they're doing horribly and nothing's changed, it can smooth all of that out and reduce your medicines. And so then it really is worth what's involved in going through surgery.
What kind of surgeries are out there? Is it painful? Are there high risks? We'll break it down. But
sure. Well, it's a serious undertaking, obviously. What's involved in surgery is the general concept right now is that there are these hyperactive areas, as I said earlier, in this circuit that controls movement. The dopamine can be viewed as sort of the key to the ignition when you're starting a car. If you lose the key, you can't start the car. But if you know how to hotwire the car, then you can obviously get the car running, and then it'll run just fine. So what we're essentially trying to do with surgery is we put a little small electrode, about a millimeter in size, which is pretty thin, and we put it into a key spot in this circuit beyond where the dopamine is needed, beyond the key to the ignition, to try to jumpstart the rest of the circuit, to try to control the flow of information in the rest of the circuit by sending these little electrical pulses. So a wire goes into this spot deep in the brain, and then it gets hooked up to a wire that runs under the skin that gets connected to a battery in the chest that looks just like a pacemaker. And then we can have a little programming device that over several weeks after surgery can adjust the settings to individual patients to optimize it for them.
So my understanding that these operations are done awake, so it's not a terribly painful operation for the patient.
Well, it's like going to the dentist to some degree. It's not fun. It's not something we do on a Saturday night by choice. But having said that, we can take measures to control discomfort. So the most painful parts are obviously we have to put this little box on the head that's a frame that allows us to navigate inside the brain using these computers that we have. So putting that on requires a little bit of local anesthesia to numb up the spots in the scalp where it's going to be fixed to the head. And then when we open up a small incision, a small opening in the scalp that is maybe half the size of a pencil, and that has to be numbed up also. But the brain itself has no pain in it, and so once we get through and we make a little hole in the skull, there's really no pain involved after that.
I mean, I know it would be hard to explain why. You know, when you talk to patients with Parkinson's disease, they're very skeptical. They're afraid of the surgery. It's not risky in terms of the range of brain surgeries out there. This is not terribly risky, is it?
Well, there are some risks, obviously, and that's why we don't do it on just everybody for no reason. But like anything in surgery, the potential to benefit in properly chosen patients is so substantial that the risks are more than justified. So the most serious risk is a risk that you could have some bleeding inside the brain, because we are going through a path that we choose on our computers based on an image that we take, an MRI image in advance of surgery. If there's a little something, a little vein or something that the MRI did not pick up, we have no way of seeing that, and it's a slight chance that we could go through it. Having said that, the number of people that have actually died from an operation like this are much less than most other neurosurgical procedures. People have had some, I mean, there's no question that people have had some injuries from the operation, like any surgery, but it's really about 1 in 100, maybe less than 1 in 100 if you really properly choose patients. You've got to compare that. And then, of course, there's people, like any surgery, can get infections or things, but those are usually well managed. Yeah. Compare that to if you go to a specialist who knows how to pick the patients properly and who knows how to do the surgery properly. If those two things are achieved, usually about 85% to 90% of patients will have a meaningful benefit. That doesn't mean, like any surgery, that doesn't mean that everybody will get the same benefit.
But most, there's a 90% chance.
But about 85 better. To 90% of patients who are properly chosen and who, where the operation is done properly, will have enough benefit that they feel that it was worth going through. It's changed their lives in a meaningful way.
You and Dr. During are one of the thought leaders on the applications of gene therapy for diseases involving, you know, the brain and spine. Tell us a little bit about this new therapy that you've come up with and where we are with it, the gene therapy for Parkinson's disease.
Sure. Well, gene therapy essentially involves taking a gene, which is the fundamental blueprint, the information of life that tells our cells what to do and how to function, taking a key gene that might change the way a cell works for the good and putting that gene into a patient's own cells. For Parkinson's specifically, what we've tried to do is take advantage of what we already know works in people, the surgery I just mentioned, and go into the same spot and try to put, instead of an electrode that's leaving a wire and a battery and all of these things, put a gene in that will change the way that cell functions to make it go back to normal functioning, change the way the circuit functions back to normal without leaving anything behind. So this gene makes a chemical that the brain naturally needs and that is deficient in these areas in Parkinson's. So we're trying to reestablish with this gene therapy the natural neurochemical environment of the circuit to reestablish normal movements.
How many patients have you done this on now?
So we did what's known as a phase one study, which is a safety study. When you do clinical trials, there's a progression. You start with a small number of patients, and you try different doses to prove that it's safe. And then with that information, and hopefully some information about how well it works, you go on to larger, more definitive studies. So in our study, we did 12 patients. And we were only allowed to operate on one side of the brain because it was the first time anybody had done anything like this for any adult neurological disease. And therefore, if there was something unexpected that happened, it would be a little safer if it only happened on one side. So we treated the side of the brain. Most Parkinson's patients that are advanced eventually have problems on both sides of the body and both sides of the brain. But still, most of them have it worse on one side, the side that it started on, even in later stages. So we treated the worst side, and then we followed them for a year. Our first patient was treated 3.5 years ago, and our last patient was treated almost 2 years ago. The study formally lasted a year, but so it's been over for almost a year.
And how are those patients doing?
So the patients are doing very well. Our first patient I just recently spoke to, who's doing very well. We had no complications from this, no toxicities of any kind related to the gene therapy, which when you think about it, what we're doing here is taking these little genetic packages, are using a modified virus that is found normally in the body and changing that virus in a way so that it can't cause disease but will deliver the gene package into your cells. We're injecting in the lowest dose, 3 billion of these viral particles into this small spot in the brain using a volume of fluid about the size of one drop from an eyedropper. In the highest dose, we're injecting 30 billion of these little viral particles into that same spot, and yet none of our patients even had a fever. So that certainly in its own right was quite satisfying. In terms of the outcomes, we showed a significant improvement in their so-called off state, meaning when their medicines weren't working, they were significantly improved. In addition, what we recently found, which was surprising to us, was that even in their on state, even when their medicine was working, they also were significantly improved. That's actually surprising to us because the traditional surgery, this brain stimulation, usually works best in the off state and does not show meaningful improvements in the on state. So that was very encouraging. And then we did brain imaging to see how the brain was changing. And we saw with brain imaging that the circuits in the brain were actually normalizing. And all of this was referable to the side that was treated. The other side of those patients' brains actually served as a comparison, and it did not change for the better. So it actually gave us confidence that we hope that these are real findings, but obviously we now have to go on to much more larger definitive studies.
And that will be happening?
And that is in the works right now.
Right. Just listening to you, it brings up the thought of the physician scientist. Is that a dying breed?
Well, hopefully not. It's a tough breed. it's a difficult thing to do, obviously. The NIH is recognizing that it's important and is really trying to promote the idea of so-called translational medicine. But ultimately, the problem is that when you're a physician, you need to spend the time to stay at a high level of skill so that your patients are well cared for. While at the same time, if you want to be a scientist, you need to spend the time being up on your field and being actively involved in your lab research so that you can make progress. For those of us who really want to get at the fundamental root causes and potential novel treatments for diseases, we can't. I'm an example of someone who just can't see any way around doing both to try to bring new technologies to human disease. The only way to really do that well, in my opinion, or the easiest way, is to focus, which is very important. So that's why my research, as you can see with the gene therapy, is focused on areas that relate directly to my specialty. In my specialty, I don't do general neurosurgery. I don't do aneurysms or other things in neurosurgery. And so it allows me to stay very good at my specific area while working on the research. But obviously, with the NIH cutting budgets, because that's very difficult, and the funding levels have gone increasingly down, and with pressures from hospitals to stay afloat, which means doing more clinical cases because that brings in money to the hospitals, it's very difficult to be able to do both and really make ends meet, and it requires a very supportive institution. Cornell, you mentioned one of my titles is this Victor Enteromenesis Clinical Scholar. That is because our institution has actually sought out supporters to help people like myself, provide some of those funds so that we don't have to be doing as much clinical work just for financial reasons, and we can then do our laboratory work, but you need that kind of support.
Do you think in the future, however, we'll be going more in the direction of I'm the clinician, and then there's a PhD in the lab, and we have to communicate on a regular basis, but you get split into two people?
Well, I think that has a lot of value, but I hope that people like myself won't disappear, because I really genuinely think that there is great value in having someone who goes from the clinical setting and says, you know, this is a problem that I think we can fix, and goes back to the laboratory and can transition between those two worlds.
We're going to have to take a short break. Please stay with us. Do you have to suffer for the rest of your life if you're having pain? What are the medical answers? Does surgery have an answer for pain? Or are there alternative forms of therapy? Stay with us and we'll answer these questions.
Thank you.
Welcome back to How to Save Your Life. I'm Dr. Philip Stieg, your host, and with me this evening is Dr. Michael Caplet, the Victor and Tara Meneses Clinical Scholar of Neurosciences at Weill Medical College. One of Dr. Caplet's areas of interest is in the management of pain. What is pain?
Well, pain is a way that it's essentially a warning signal to our body. Pain is a perception of something that is noxious. That's not noxious is a term that means that it's something that's not pleasant. The reason pain exists is because of the fact that we need some way of knowing that if your hand is on a hot stove, for example, that you remove it before significant damage is done. So pain has a real purpose. But obviously, for a lot of people, unfortunately, this is something that gets out of control and is no longer a warning signal, but a problem.
From a public health standpoint, this is a huge issue, isn't it?
Enormous, yeah.
There's a large number of clinical dollars and rehabilitation dollars spent on this.
Sure. I mean, when you put together back pain, which is enormous, and headache, and then all the other specific types of pain, it is enormous.
One of the things that always strikes me is if I look at members of my family and patients that I see, is just the different response to what they describe as painful stimuli. Some people are absolutely stoic, and you're sitting there looking at them in astonishment that they're sitting up straight. Right. And other patients come in and they're crying, and you don't think that it should be that bad. Why? Why the difference? Is it environmental, genetic?
Well, obviously that's a complicated question. But having said that, there's no question that there's a significant individual component to pain. Pain is perception. Unlike a lot of the diseases that we treat in neurosurgery where there's something you can tangibly put your eyes or fingers on, an aneurysm, a tumor, or something like that, pain is an issue of perception. If a anesthesiologist gives you a spinal anesthetic so that they cut off the information from the spine to the brain, I can cut your arm off or your leg off, let's say, and you would never feel it because that information is not reaching the brain. So obviously, if the brain has to process the information for you to ultimately feel it as pain, then other things in the brain can modulate or alter that perception of pain. And so there's no question that there is a psychological component where some people can control their pain better than others, and vice versa, some people might be more sensitive. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is, as we would maybe as general people would refer to it, as crazy, or that it's really by their choice. Pain has to be perceived, like psychiatric diseases, as a brain disorder as much as it is a functional disorder. And a lot of people just assume that someone who has pain is just a complainer, or someone who's depressed should just snap out of it. And these are brain disorders, but there's no question that your makeup can influence how you perceive the same painful stimulus.
Well, one of the major problems a lot of the listeners have is knowing where to turn, both for Parkinson's disease and also for the pain population. Are there web pages that people can look at to find out who to go to, and in particular with pain? I mean, what kind of doctors do you start with?
Oh, sure. Well, there are a lot of societies for pain for specific types. There are headache societies. There are general pain societies for specific types of pain. There are these things. The best resource for web information are usually major universities that have major pain programs. We have several websites in our neurosurgery site and our anesthesiology site that can be helpful to people, and so do other institutions. As far as what doctor to go to, it's always tough because people, for example, who have facial pain often go to their dentist first because they assume it's a tooth problem. And it may be, but if there's no clear tooth problem, then who do you go to? Sometimes people will go to a neurologist if they have back or arm pain, thinking maybe they have a herniated disc, or they'll go right to a neurosurgeon or orthopedist. Some people will go to a pain management specialist. Pain management specialists are often anesthesiologists who no longer work in the operating room to help people go to sleep for surgery. They specialize in helping to manage pain through medicines. And then there are rehabilitation physicians who do the same. So it is an incredibly difficult and gray area. The best advice I can give to people is that if you're having terrible pain and you go to a specialist and they don't have an obvious cause. You go to an orthopedist or you go to a dentist and they cannot find a structural cause, an abnormality in your body that they can clearly say this is the cause of your pain, then you should really go to a pain management specialist who can help you sort through some of these issues a little bit better.
What do you say to the people? I personally think that a lot of people are afraid to go to the doctor. And so before they even get to a physician, they start trying alternate forms of therapy.
Right.
Are there any that work? And if not, which ones should we avoid?
Well, again, there are alternate forms that can work. It's always important to remember what I said at the beginning. Pain usually is telling us something. So you should not start with alternate forms, because if you have pain because you have a herniated disc, let's say, or some other problem that needs to be fixed, that is telling you that that could progress to the point where it would cause you to be weak or paralyzed in an area, and you want to catch it before that happens. Where the alternative therapies might be reasonable is if you've gone through all of that, and now it's clear that you don't have something that needs to be fixed. And if a pain management specialist is not able to adequately help you or find the source, there are times, and I've recommended this to patients, where things like acupuncture can sometimes be very effective. Now, there are a variety of things that are experimental, or people have all kinds of alternative herbs and things. They may or may not have some value, but you really have to critically assess whether or not something has been really tested in a solid way before you really start going and using it.
So, I mean, most individuals, again, are going to want to avoid surgery or anything like
sure.
that. But when is enough enough when it comes to medical management
right.
for pain? I mean, I presume you're not seeing patients that are on narcotics or...
Oh, no, sure. We see patients who are on all kinds of medicine. Most of the patients that come to surgery for a neurosurgical pain procedure have tried an enormous amount of medications. In fact, I will turn down patients and send them to a pain specialist if they've not done such a thing, if they've not been adequately treated medically, because, as you say, patients are not the only ones who believe that medicine is better than surgery if you can avoid surgery. So do I. But when you reach a point where the pain is no longer tolerable, or where you've tried all of these medications and it's just not doing it for you, if you can't find a cause that can be fixed, then considering a surgical procedure is appropriate. These are often patients, let's say, who've had an injury. I've seen a lot of younger people who've had orthopedic injuries. They broke a leg, they broke a foot in college or in high school or something, and their body developed a reactive process where their pain just gets worse and worse, even though their leg is fixed. And we can help with that. Patients who have trigeminal neuralgia, which is a type of facial pain that often is thought to be a tooth problem, but there's no tooth problem when you go to the dentist, and it's a type of sort of shooting pain in the face. We can help with that if medicine is not terribly effective. So the medicines usually try to quiet down these abnormally active pain nerves, but if they're not doing the job, we can be helpful.
You're focusing a little bit on that, you know, tic douloureux or trigeminal neuralgia, which is the facial pain that I think a lot of people suffer from. How common is it for somebody to go and have a tooth pulled before they finally get to see you?
You'd be amazed how often I see this in my practice. In the last 6 months, I've probably seen 4 or 5 patients who had more than one tooth pulled because there was a thought that there was something abnormal in there, even though there wasn't any great confidence on the x-rays that there was something wrong. And of course, there turned out to be nothing wrong underneath.
So what? So the patient can try to avoid this treatment that obviously isn't necessary. What symptoms should they be looking for with this?
Well, pain that starts without an obvious cause, pain that sort of comes and goes all of a sudden very spasmodically. It suddenly just comes in these terrible waves, maybe for a few days or a few weeks on and off, and then will subside. It's usually sort of radiating down the face in a particular pattern. There are 3 branches to the nerve that control pain or sensation to the face. And essentially, they run across down the jaw, across the cheek, and up over the eye. And so those are the 3 different branches. And if you have pain specifically running across your cheek and up your nose or radiating down the jaw in this type of shooting, electrical, burning fashion, then that, without any other cause, that could be trigeminal neuralgia, especially if you've gone to a dentist, let's say, and they don't see any abnormality in your teeth or your gums.
Does trauma play a role in the development of this? Can somebody have a tooth pulled and then develop trigeminal neuralgia?
You can. I've seen that. Unfortunately, that's what's known as denervation pain. We see that in the rest of the body as well. When somebody has had an injury, and a tooth extraction is an injury. It's not by accident, but when you pull a tooth, the nerves going into the tooth are necessarily damaged. Most people, that's not a problem. They recover. Some people can have a reactive process where the damage to that nerve sets off a whole cascade of events. What's unfortunate is that a patient with trigeminal neuralgia will already have a reactive nerve that's already causing pain, and now you get a tooth pulled in that setting, and I've seen where it can really worsen that problem.
And there for that pain syndrome, there are both medical and surgical treatments?
Yes. So the mainstay of medical therapy are actually drugs designed to treat seizures because, as I said, these are hyperactive nerves that are firing like crazy. Well, epilepsy, a seizure, is a part of the brain that's just firing abnormally and then that spreads. The medicines are designed to quiet that down. It's been found that for pain syndromes, and particularly facial pain like this, those can be very effective. But when those begin to fail, then surgery can be a very important treatment for these patients.
One of the interesting things I think in dealing with pain patients is the, you know, just the whole psychological overlay. You know, even in the patient who truly has, say, something like trigeminal neuralgia, don't they also have, I mean, there's their reaction, their emotional reaction to the pain.
They have to.
And how do you, I mean, how do you treat that separate from the pain?
Well,
or don't you?
You can't. That's why if you're interested in treating pain, you have to have a multidisciplinary group of all of these types of physicians that you can call on to help you. I've had psychiatrists and therapists that I've worked with sometimes in extreme situations. But you have to be willing to sit there and understand your individual patient and work through some of these. I've told residents and students all the time that when they say, they'll say, oh, I think that that patient is just nuts, let's say. And I will jokingly say all pain patients are nuts to some degree. Because there's no way that you can have a type of pain that prevents you from working, that prevents you from living your life day after day for years without it affecting your psyche. It's not your fault. It's real. The real tough part in determining who's a good candidate for surgery is trying to find those patients where the physiological cause, the abnormally firing nerve, the damage, the scarring from prior surgeries or injuries, those types of things, where that represents the majority of their pain, and the psychological overlay, which needs to be managed, represents sort of the minority of that portion of the pain.
Some of the people who manage pain, that whole area has been invaded by, you know, the companies with the technology.
Yeah.
What kind of new technology is out now, and where do you think that's going?
Well, there are several technologies that have been refined that have been around to some degree for many years, but the devices are much better nowadays. There's a device called a spinal cord stimulator, for example, that we put in. Jerry Lewis had one of these put in. He had debilitating pain for many years, and this helped him enormously. What this does is it tries to send little electrical pulses to the spinal cord to block the pain sensation from getting to the brain. It's based on the same theory as what we do naturally. If you burn your hand, let's say, what's the first thing you do instinctively? You rub your hand to make it feel better. You're doing the same thing. You're trying to create a rubbing sensation that's trying to take away the pain sensation from that same area. What we do is we put an electrode on the spine attached to a little battery, and it sends these little buzzes that creates a tingling sensation in the area where you feel pain, and that essentially confuses the brain and hopefully stops the pain sensation. It can be very effective for people with nerve damage or nerve injury type pains who've had back surgery and had problems, who've had orthopedic injuries, etc. And then there are people in my area of interest, for example, who are trying to develop gene therapies for pain, biological therapies, and there are a lot of new drugs coming out.
You said something earlier that I think needs to be emphasized for the people listening is, you know, a lot of these things have been around a long, long time. But, you know, just like we're not using Fortran on our computers anymore,
yeah,
you're able to do more because the devices are smaller, they're more responsive, and they're better.
Absolutely. We can adjust them to the patient better. What people have to understand is that pain is not their fault. Pain is one of those things that often can carry a stigma. Part of that is because people who don't have a good answer for it often get tired. Even physicians, they don't know how to help it, and therefore they simply stop trying because it's a natural human instinct. But there are things for a lot of people that can be very effective. It just takes time to understand the patient and to bring, whether it's medicine or surgery, to that patient to tailor it to help them with their pain.
Now, we kind of talked a little bit about, you know, spine pain and, you know, the Jerry Lewis situation with electrical stimulators. Are there also chemicals you can put in with pumps?
Absolutely, yeah. There's a pump that you can pump drugs directly onto the spinal cord in the areas where there's pain, so that for people who, let's say, where medication is helping them enormously or even helping them somewhat, but they have terrible side effects. You can't stay awake. You can't think straight. You get nauseous. This will take the drug and deliver a much higher dose directly where it's needed on the spinal cord and not affect the rest of the body so much. And it can be enormously helpful to people with terrible back pain and also to cancer patients, where I do a lot of that, who have terrible cancer pain.
And for those that don't respond to any of these things, is there anything you can do at the level of the brain to kind of take away their pain?
Well, there are. These are obviously the very rare cases, but as I said earlier, pain is a pain perception problem. We can go into some of those areas of the brain that process pain and try to change the way they function by putting electrodes there, or ultimately by destroying them, by going in and just taking them out. And that can help certain patients with pain who have been resistant to everything else.
Again, it's been a delight to have with us Dr. Michael Caplet, the Victor and Tara Meneses Clinical Scholar of Neurosciences at Weill Medical College of Cornell University. We've been talking about the management of Parkinson's disease, and another major health problem is treatment of pain. Those of you that do have pain truly are suffering, and there are physicians like Dr. Caplet who want to help. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Philip Stieg is the chairman of the Department of Neurological Surgery at Weill Cornell Medical College and neurosurgeon-in-chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Joe Woodruff is our producer. The executive producer is Alan Chartok. Our audio engineer is Adam Claremont. Production support for How to Save Your Life comes from the Department of Neurological Surgery, Weill Cornell Medical College, New York Presbyterian Hospital. How to Save Your Life is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content.